Thank you for downloading this episode of Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. To get more episodes and explore other SDN and network automation resources, visit sdn.ipspace.net.
If you're a networking engineer, you know how testing after a change goes, right? You prepare for the test, you schedule the maintenance window, you wait for 3 weeks to get the maintenance window, then you do your stuff, you do a few pings and trace routes, and then you go home, and the next morning you get like 100 tickets because you changed an access control list and you never checked the connectivity. Smarter people do a screenshot of Nagios' screen before and after the change to prove that it's not the network that caused the outage, but there must be better ways to do things. So Chris Young approached me a while ago saying, well, we should do a podcast on testing the network and automating the testing. And I said, sure, sounds like a great idea. Find a few guests and off we go. And he brought our friend David Barroso. And joining us today are also David G. and Eliza Yashinska. Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Chris, it's more or less your show. Will you drive it or shall I be in the driving seat?
I think there's enough personalities on this call that we'll have, four or five hands on the wheel?
Okay, let's start.
Let's start. So in general, you know, this is as my journey from networking engineer to software, I don't even know what I would call myself at this point. I seem to spend more time in an IDE or writing code than I do on actual network gear. So I don't even know what I am. But during that journey, at some point, the whole I should actually test this stuff comes up. And as I've gotten more and more and more into testing, as far as just looking at different unit testing and functional testing and integration testing and smoke testing, and realizing that most networking engineers don't do any of it. So as we've moved into this infrastructure as code, what I thought it would be a really good thing to kind of discuss, and as some of you have been further down this path than I have been, is kind of get your point of view on what makes sense as far as testing. What are these different kinds of tests that we go through from a software development traditional standpoint, and just kind of have that conversation in general, because I'm here to learn as well. It's an interesting time for all of us. So does that sound good to everybody?
Yes.
So David, you're our expert today. How does that make you feel?
I don't know if I would call myself an expert.
and that's why you qualify.
That's good.
I do recognize the problem statement here, though, because I kind of had a very similar journey going into software development and like trying to test things and going around like, how does all of this work? Discovering like, wow, this is awesome.
Okay. And I'll echo that as well. Same here. And to your point, Chris, I've not touched networking gear in probably about a year, maybe. Just IDE and building things. And to Lisa's point, yeah, testing is one of those things. And even in software, people don't do it.
Okay, so yeah, let's start with the easy one. Why should you test?
Silence.
Yeah.
So I guess from my point of view, where I came into this is I guess the first thing is the unit test, right? So what is the definition of a unit test for you guys? For me, it's just the smallest possible thing that you can test. So part of the testing from my point of view is that you should be testing to make sure that the smallest possible things are not the things that are causing you trouble, like MTU sizes, for instance, because those never cause any problems.
I mean, it depends on what you are trying to test, I guess. I mean, I find unit tests useful when you're writing like a library to do small things. Like, I don't know, for example, you're working with Ansible and you start doing your Jinja filters. So testing those filters is actually a unit test, right? Like, because filters do like very, very specific things. When you're testing like bigger software, like you're writing an API, I don't know if unit tests makes that much sense, because I mostly care about the outcome. I want to make sure that if I do a particular call, I'm going to get a particular response. So, I mean, unit tests are interesting for certain things, but there is this mantra that people say that you should be like unit testing everything. But I mean, it becomes a hassle just trying to unit test everything, because there's a lot of code in some software and it becomes just too much, I think.
Well, to add to that, I unit test against instances of, let's say, a lab piece of kit. So even calling an API, I'll version something and then even have something going off and calling some remote instead of mocking it locally. Because the other thing is, well, even your mock could be wrong. So then you have to have a test for your test almost in some cases.
And on the other hand, there's always something that's like the minimum viable piece of code that you use in your setup. So, for example, sometimes in my Ansible playbooks, I would transform the external data model into per node data model. because it's easier to work if you have variables per node, not some crazy data model that describes services, which David loves to do. And I would write unit tests for that particular thing. For example, I would have service with enabled on one port, enabled on two ports, enabled on three ports, enabled on many ports, and then verify that things actually work the right way.
So David, you're leaning more towards functional tests. Did you actually get what you wanted out of it as more useful?
I mean, as I was saying, it depends on the use case. When I'm, for example, if we use the Ansible example again, when I'm writing like modules or like filters, then I try to rely on unit tests to make sure that those small units work as intended. But if I'm writing like an entire playbook, like you would probably prefer to do more like functional testing, right? Like to have like some VM or Docker container or whatever and just have it on a known state and then run the playbook and make sure that you get to an expected state.
Well, I was bitten by Nexus OS so many times that I started writing unit tests for each getter I have in my Ansible playbooks.
That seems a bit hardcore.
Well, you know, I got to this situation where they would return different data structure if you have one VLAN configured on the box versus if you have more than one VLAN configured on the box.
Of course, then it's a list. It's always like that.
Well, if you have one, they don't return a list of one, they return a dictionary. If you have more than one, they return a list of dictionaries.
You know, I figured out, I ran into this problem a lot as well, and I figured out that seems to be something that happens a lot when you translate from XML into a dictionary, because like the standard libraries that do that translation like to do it that way.
Ah, that's it. Okay, nice. Anyway, so I wrote this unit test where I would push certain configuration onto the box and do my get function and verify that I can handle both cases, one versus many. Anyway, in the meantime, Christian Larsen joined us. Hi, Christian.
Hi. Hi, everyone.
You're new to this show. More or less everyone else has been on one of the previous shows. So let's stop the unit test for a moment. Christian, what are you doing in real life when you're not on a podcast?
Right. Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's lovely to be here. So in my everyday life, I'm working within Deutsche Telekom on a project called TerraStream, which is a kind of a next generation fixed network. And I am specifically working on the management software of this. So it's provisioning, collecting, operational data, monitoring of the network, and of course, a lot of testing of all of this code that it involves doing this. That kind of sums up my everyday, I think.
Okay, so we already started going down the testing discussions and got stuck on the first step, which is unit tests. So where would you use unit tests and why would you do them or not?
Right, so if we look in our environment, of course, I'm going to speak a lot about what we're doing in our environment. We don't actually have that much unit tests because I think that when writing these network provisioning software, it's the most helpful part is when you can test, you know, slightly larger pieces and not just individual units. The unit tests, I mean, it's usually about testing individual functions. We do have them, for example, in our code that calculates IP addresses to be used. We verify that that is doing the correct thing through unit tests. But in a lot of the provisioning components, you find that there are so many aspects of that trying to apply unit tests is not a great fit. We tend to use more of a integration testing or a kind of an end-to-end test in those cases.
And okay. Those are really the hard ones, right? Because the unit tests are like, okay, something simple. I can write something that, you know, pretends to be that function and run through it. But I always find like you write your library, you write your unit tests along that, and then kind of taking it to the next level and doing integration testing on that is always like the harder part to solve. What did you guys do about that?
When we started this, I was thinking a lot about how we could actually do testing on this. And then when you start thinking about provisioning, you know, what is provisioning? It's kind of, you know, you're sending out text configuration, right? So it's just text. And perhaps the very first thing that you do is you take this text output and you start comparing it to some, you know, intended text kind of. And through that, you can verify that your provisioning system does what it's supposed to do. And I think one of the problems with this is that you don't have any inherent knowledge of, you know, networking when you do it like this. You could, for example, create an ISIS configuration or a BGP configuration that doesn't actually make sense. And so what we try to do when we verify the network is that we provision a virtual network. So we use virtual routers. And when we verify, we actually collect, you know, operational data from these routers, and we make sure that the kind of the end result that we want to get at is what we achieve. So in the case of ISIS, we configure ISIS on two virtual routers, and then we ask them, you know, do you have an ISIS adjacency established on this interface? And if the answer is yes, then there's a good chance that our configuration is correct. And through that, we can infer that our provisioning system has done the correct thing. So that's kind of how the... And through this, we also cover a huge chunk. We cover both the provisioning part and the, you know, collection of operational data and making sure that this is correct and so forth. So we cover a good chunk. Of course, the negative side of that is if something in this chain goes wrong, it's kind of difficult to pinpoint exactly what is wrong.
I was going to say that was my immediate thought was, okay, if that test fails, then what?
then someone probably has to go in and look at this manually. But if you start thinking about it, like, where do you start out, right? You want to, in a short amount of time, cover large parts of the network. And I found that this methodology is very good at that. If you do encounter, you know, an issue somewhere and maybe you want to add extra tests around that to make sure that the finer details of something is tested.
Which brings us, I guess, to the regression testing. So you found a bug, you wrote a test that proves that the bug is there. You fix the bug, you run the test, you prove that the bug, at least the one that the test discovered, is no longer there. So how do you make sure that this bug never reappears if you just use the functional testing?
Yeah, I think that what you outlined there pretty much covers it, right? You just need to make sure that it's difficult to talk about this without an actual example, right? But I mean, you simply have to test that particular detail that you probably left out in the original test case, because otherwise it would have been caught at the very start, right? So as you move, you discover one of these things. Now you have to add it to your test suite and make sure that it runs for all future and eternity. And if that ever pops up again, then you'll discover it. I think that you mentioned functional testing. I don't think it matters if you test as with functional testing or with more detailed knowledge of the particular system. Regardless, you just have to add more test cases for these kind of regression tests. I guess the main drawback, and this is something that we're kind of struggling right now with, is in your CI environment, it's very nice if your entire test suite runs in a few minutes because it keeps it interactive for the developers. And once you start adding all of these tests, it's very easy that it all of a sudden it's taking hours to run. And I guess that's, for me at least, you know, a little bit of the difference between a full-blown regression test suite where you go through so many different cases versus perhaps the first steps in your CI environment should probably be something that runs a lot faster.
So you would have like some quick tests that just prove that you haven't broken anything major. And then every now and then you would run in the background the full suite of regression tests to verify that you haven't broken anything that has been fixed before.
Yes, I think that that's the pretty much the only way that it actually can work. If you try to meet all of these things, it's nice to be able to get some kind of first verification after a couple of minutes that your code that you just committed didn't break, you know, everything. And so if you want to do that, but at the same time, you want to have very extensive testing, then you simply have to divide it into different parts. And so we're also trying to do this in our CI environment. We're spinning up a network of virtual routers, and that is kind of the main playground for the CI tests as they happen. But we also have a physical lab network, which is also controlled by our CI environment. It works very differently because with a virtual router, you spin it up and in a matter of a couple of minutes, you have a fresh router. Now, on the other hand, if you go and do a factory reset on a large router, a Juniper MX or a Cisco ASR 9K or something, it can take you 30 minutes to do a factory reset of it. So if you want to, you know, use a physical lab, then, you know, you're simply not going to do as many CI runs as you are with a virtual counterpart. So maybe you actually just do a nightly run or something like this. And then you can do all of your regression testing on that as well.
So if you do all of this kind of testing up front, you do test pass, and you push your code. To Ivan's point, if you execute all of the quicker tests and you think, oh, actually, I'm in a real rush to get this configuration out, and then you push a configuration out in the background, run the longer jobs, and then you find an issue, but by which point you've pushed a code out into production, I guess there's two questions. A, what do you do? Or B, do you not take that risk?
Yeah, that's a good question, right? So I'd say the, you know, the main path here is that you can, you know, you can look at that first CI run as the kind of quick feedback to developer. That is the primary purpose of it. So you can merge this to master. And then after that, that's when you run this, you know, the complete regression testing suite. And deploying to your production environments, that's something that happens after you've gone through the entire regression testing suite, right? It is, however, possible for a developer to deploy something before you've gone through the entire regression testing. So I guess if you do push that deploy button, you'd better be certain that, you know, you haven't made a boo-boo in your code and that it actually works, right?
It's an interesting point. It's a real interesting one. And I think in the real world, we all see instances where something is half working and the management team says, hey, this is great. Push it out now. We need this, you know, we need to make monies off this. And I think this is where something we do on a daily basis, or say we, I mean, I look at building remediation systems to try and figure out if there are known failures and then, you know, take the Facebook approach and build a pattern to mend something. But I don't know. I mean, if you are very strict and you say no developer should push out early, and if you do, well, you know, we're going to come and beat you up and steal your coffee or something. It's just one of those interesting ones.
You can also have different testing rules for different situations, right? Like, for example, if you're pushing code to your own branch because you're working there, I mean, you could just be doing like some lightweight tests. But then when you're trying to merge that code into master, then you run the full-blown soot test.
I don't know, maybe a wild question here. When configurations are built for, say, an environment, do you define the tests independently or in the config files? Do you put any metadata in there so you can almost have a piece of code that goes off and builds a test automatically? So almost in coding world, any kind of compiler or linker meter information?
So what we kind of do is, it's a mix. I should start off by saying it's a little bit of a mix. It depends on what we're currently testing. Most of the configuration that we have in our network, we have these abstract concepts, which are called services. And a service is not something that you necessarily sell to a customer. A service could also be something internal. Have a base configuration service, which you apply to a router, which applies, you know, the kind of the foundational stuff of your configuration. You have a service for IBGP neighbors. You have one for backbone links. You have one for peering, you know, peering interface, and so on and so forth. And what we do as part of this service, we kind of bake in fetching of operational data and making sure that this is correct into the service itself. So this is how we do a lot of the testing, that we actually, you know, we build up both the provisioning part and the, you know, fetching of monitoring data. That's all in our code. And we use that code to also verify that both of these parts kind of do the same thing, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So in that way, they are very intertwined. If you change your topology that you have in this network of virtual routers, then when you kind of ask the network, right? You know, are you feeling okay? Then you just iterate over all of those service instances, like the backbone interface. You ask that instance, hey, are you feeling okay? And it will say, yes, I'm feeling okay because my interface is up. I have an ISI's adjacency, and the other end, the adjacency, is actually the one that I expect it to be. I have a PIM neighbor, which is also something that's expected. And so when all of these things check, he says, yes, I'm okay. So you can, you know, just iterate through this and through that if your network is working or not.
Do you run that as part of some testing suite or just as part of your regular monitoring?
Both. We use the same thing in monitoring the network as well as in CI testing of it. And of course, in the CI testing environment, then we know that these links are supposed to be up. So the monitoring of them should return a true. And of course, it's possible here that if you mess up the code for the monitoring part of this, it could report that a service is working when in fact it is not. But in our experience here is that it actually does work fairly well. And through this, we kind of cover, you know, we're not writing so much code just for testing in the CI environment. Most of the testing code that we're using is actually for monitoring our real production networks. It's just that it's used in both environments.
So what tools are you actually using for your CI and monitoring?
Our provisioning system itself and most of the code, we're using TailFNCS, or, well, Cisco NSO, as it's known these days. There's also a, you know, large swath of code around this with using other systems. As for the CI environment itself, we're using GitLab CI. And we were using GitLab kind of early on, and it just became rather natural that we stick to their CI environment.
GitLab is that thing that's like GitHub, but it can also call, well, tell one of your servers that it's time to do a CI run, right?
Yes, it's very much like GitHub, but it allows you to do have everything on premise, which was important to us. And yes, when we started out with CI, we were looking at, you know, what would integrate with GitLab. And Jenkins is, I guess, one of the classic tools in this space. And we looked at that, but we also looked at GitLab CI, which at the time was very new, and they've actually, you know, rewritten the CI runner later on. But that was what we started out with. I personally have a background with Travis CI, which I think has kind of an excellent default in that every CI run that it performs, you start out with a fresh environment. It's a fresh VM. Now you can get a container for it. And GitLab CI kind of had the same thing out of the box. In Jenkins, you actually kind of have to do a few things to get that up and running. That appealed to us, as well as kind of the built-in support for using containers for your entire environment. So we let our CI runner start containers, wherein we run our test scripts, which in turn start up more containers for the virtual routers.
Okay, now I have to step like 120 steps back, because most of the people listening to this podcast are networking engineers. Let's start with a simple thing. What does CI stand for?
Right. Sorry. Yeah. Continuous integration is what CI stands for. So it's continuous
integration.
What does it mean? Yes. So typically your CI system is something that you trigger every time you write some code or you modify your code and you commit this into your version control system, such as Git, which is rather popular these days. Then to make sure everything looks okay, your CI system will take the new code and run a bunch of tests, which you've also defined. And if all looks good, then you're kind of allowed to merge this new code into the master branch on your repository.
So you're running these tests before you committed the code to the master branch. You're working on your own branch. You do some changes. You say, I think this is okay. And then someone automatically runs the tests, and the tests say, yeah, this didn't break anything that we know has to be tested.
Yes.
And the testing part is all automated, so it's not like there is a monkey sitting somewhere pressing the button every time someone does a commit or something.
Yes, exactly. But of course, you have to write the tests yourself. But it's a one-time thing, but it could be some work setting all of this up. But I think in the long term, it really pays off doing this.
And the tests you would do are the tests like what we discussed. Unit tests, integration tests, regression tests, whatever you wrote.
Yes, yes, precisely. I mean, you can start out, you know, however you want. Sometimes I get the question, you know, why should I do testing? Often people have the wrong kind of perspective on this. So when they want to roll out some configuration in their own network, they're actually going to do some tests themselves. Maybe it's a kind of a canary. You start out on one router or one switch or whatever it is you're working with, and then you perform this test, and after that you see, oh yeah, it was kind of fine over there, so then you continue doing it for the rest of the network. Now you did the test, right? Just that you did it manually. So putting it into a CI system is just about organizing your tests that you would otherwise be doing manually, and, you know, running them in a structured manner whenever you do a change, that is.
You do need a couple of space tools though to be able to do that, right? If you want to like set up your environment and then run tests in that environment, you need something that actually automatically sets up the environment itself, etc. So I've noticed there's a lot of groundwork that you kind of have to be doing before you're even able to plug it into a system like that, which always makes it a little bit harder, because typically people, you know, don't have the tools around that set up an entire lab out of VMs with all the routers, etc., etc.
And the other point, too, is the people who do have the skills to set all that up are usually not the people who know anything about networking. So we're talking about all these tests. Who is actually writing, or maybe not writing the code, but who is defining the tests as to what should be tested? Is that the developers, or are they paired with a traditional networking engineer?
So, yeah, these are all excellent points. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. It is very common. The network engineer doesn't know how to set this up. The developers, and that is, I mean, we have to draw inspiration, right? Because the software developers are the ones that kind of started all of this out, and they have usually done, you know, a lot more in this. In our case, myself and my colleagues, I have a, you know, strong background in networking, right? And programming, coding is just something I picked up to do the networking part. And most of my colleagues are the same. So it just falls naturally for us that we can do all of these things. But I do agree that is not true for a lot of people. And then I think, like someone suggested here, that pairing up a developer with a networking guy is probably the natural way to accomplish the same thing.
So a lot of those things start coming easy when you go more into software development, coming from the networking side. And I'm pretty much a full-time programmer these days. And then if you start looking at programming concepts and CI/CD and things like that, people do that, right? For them, it's relatively easy because there's so many, I can spin up a server VM, no problem, with one command and it's there, and then install a Python library on it. That's another command. And automating that is kind of okay. And then if you write code and try to do testing around writing code, it kind of comes easier than trying to do testing around an entire network setup. How do you bridge between like one and the other? How do you get from one to the other?
I mean, I think that the main problem on testing networks is actually that we have to test on like weird devices. And by weird, I mean, they're not really like Linux boxes that you can just spin very easily, just deploy some daemon and start testing against that daemon. You just have instead to like spin up an entire VM that is running iOS XR or is running Junos or EOS
With the right interfaces configured, so they will all come up, so all the monitoring is valid, right? So that requires a lot of groundwork.
Yeah, it's super hard because then you need a testing machine like running GitLab or Jenkins or whatever that has CTP, so you can actually spin up a VM, deploy the right configuration, and you have to keep doing that every time that you do a test. And that takes actually some time. Like spinning a few VMs might take like 5 to 10 minutes on each run. So I think that's the main challenge. I'm doing integration tests on both real VMs and mocked VMs. And the reason for that is I was mentioning, because if I'm testing code and I want to test it really, really quick, I prefer to mock the device. I know what input I'm giving to the device. I know what a nice behaving device would return back to me. So I can just run the test against that mock device, verify that everything is fine. And when I'm going to deploy code, then I would just like spin up this massive environment with several VMs and trying to do more like a integration test with a real operating system running.
I'm doing pretty much exactly the same thing, yeah.
And we're talking 5 and 10 minutes is a long time, but if you look at an enterprise when they're right now measuring change every 3 months, every 6 months, they're allowed a window. 5-10 minutes isn't actually that much. Again, service provider is a little different, but in the enterprise space, that's totally doable in my mind.
You have to restart the test because you realize that you put a comma in the wrong place and it takes like 10 minutes to get the okay. 10 minutes is an eternity.
Right, yeah, you have to understand that these tests, they run, I mean, it's all the time, right? So when you're doing development, you're the developer. This is very, tight loop, kind of an iterative loop when you're developing. So I agree here with David that, the longer this takes, it can be rather frustrating. When we started out, I think our test ran in like 6 minutes or something like this. And that was okay. And then it grew to 17 or 20 minutes. And you can immediately feel that sometimes those changes, you would kind of just, guesstimate some code, you put it together and you shoot it off to the CI system so that it would check that it's all okay. And when it takes 20 minutes, that means, that you can do 3 of these things an hour, kind of. It's a completely different pace. You start doing something else in between and you swap back and forth. So keeping this to a 5 minutes is pretty important actually for the developer.
Can I step in here? So we're talking about the work you've been doing, and you're a fair way down the journey. You've got the skills to be able to do this. For an organization that currently doesn't do this today, there is an on ramp, and I think there are going to be engineers listening that are going to be thinking, how do I start this journey, and where do I start? And I think if we look at the unit test versus functional test, I mean, there is a definite slope there, So kind of start with testing the basics. So let's say we take an organization or a customer here's me with my vendor hat on. Excuse me. We take an organization that wants to start doing this. Can we describe a good starting point?
Yes, we talked about the systems, and I mean that is it's a necessity. It's something that you require to even start doing this. I think the other part we also touched upon here, that's the virtual routers. We can mock things, but it's very much easier, I think, to start out developing all of the provisioning code and everything, or whatever it is you want to do when you actually have access to virtual counterparts of the devices that you use in your network. I think that's it's a prerequisite.
For people that doesn't even know where to start, I would just recommend to just like grab a VM, deploy the configuration that you want to test, and then just run a simple Ansible playbook that just gathers data from the device. I mean, that's super easy to do nowadays with Napalm or with the Ansible models that are built in. And then just start running some asserts like, okay, assert that this BGP network here is up. Assert that this interface has this IP. That's actually testing, right?
But how is your BGP neighbor up if you're running it on a VM and you don't have any other endpoint, right?
Well, then you run two VMs.
Lisa, you've just sprung my trap. So one of the things I wanted to talk about at a high level was, it was a very loaded question. I'm cruel, I'm sorry. One of the things is, it comes down to, I think, to begin this journey, you need to ask yourself a question. And do we have a culture ready to do this? And the difference is, are we ready to build networks on good designs and then being able to apply automation and testing around that? Or if we have an organization that is very fluid and very organic, then you're going to have to do some house cleaning first. Because if you've got engineers going off and building things and adding tweaks all the time to keep customers happy, then you've got a culture problem because it means all your testing might pass, but then things will fail anyway.
Sure, that is true. But I think that it also, I mean, let's imagine you're one of the guys working for this company and you do have an interest then, you know, in putting up and building one of these systems. Just by doing that, you might, you know, attract some of your colleagues to start using this new little virtual environment that you built up for doing tests of their own before they actually deploy something. So, you know, you make it easy to do the right thing and maybe people will actually do the right thing.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm naive.
Well,
so cute.
I think you have to sell this to management somehow, right? Like, I mean, if you're in a certain company, they have to be like, I don't know, PCI compliant or any other process certification. I mean, this is just a way to improve on that certification, right? To meet some criteria. Like, we are testing things before they go into
automated IT control objective verification. The auditors will love you.
Change control, right?
The real world for this, I mean, I talk to customers a lot about this kind of thing. Some people are all the way, exactly like Deutsche Telekom, they're so far down the journey, it's incredible. But on the left hand of the spectrum, a lot of network engineers don't seem to realize that, you know, if you talk about an API like a REST API or NetConf, when you do that and compare it with the CLI, well, you know, will these things work on networking gear? And the journey's not even began. It surprises me sometimes that there are a lot of kind of traditional engineering houses that see the CLI or see a networking device as something amazing. You know, will your API test run properly because, you know, it's a networking thing? And I think this just comes back to culture again and again and again, and you've got to have the right hook into that. And that's just something I'll throw out. It's just one of my pain points almost on a weekly basis at the moment.
Well, David, let's be realistic. If you have the right gear, 90% of the data you need is not accessible through API.
Yep.
So from a mental model of how you look at the network as, and then this kind of goes for everybody, as you have moved from a traditional networking engineer, which most people from what I've seen, they're able to hop from device to device to device from a mental model. Do you find yourself shifting from looking at the network as a bunch of individual devices to more of a system, a connected system that just happens to have all these, you know, functions kind of tying back and forth? Or are you still seeing things from the perspective of an individual device? Does that question make sense?
The way I see the network nowadays is, for me, it's just data. I don't care about devices or vendors or anything. It's just data. I have a bunch of interfaces. They have these IPs. I have this BGP daemon running, which is parameters. That's it. I just have to test that the data is correct. And to be, well, there are certain rules that you can follow to test that the data is correct. And then just let some other system translate that data into native configuration. I don't really care about configuration of devices anymore. I just care about data.
Yeah, I agree. It used to be for me, I knew a lot more about the specific or, you know, individual platforms and how they did things, how you could, you know, all those little special knobs they had and so forth. And once you've built a bit of an abstraction, you now have something that's kind of vendor neutral, then all of that goes away and you start thinking more in your own abstractions than anything else. Yeah, I agree.
How do you deal with versioning? So let's say you change a design. Is it something that you check it into a repository with a different version, or do you start a new repository?
For me, it's actually quite simple because I regenerate the configuration every single time I do a deployment. Like, I might be changing a description. I don't care. I'm going to rebuild the entire device state. So for me, it's just a field somewhere. Like, okay, I'm running this version of the system. Then the Ansible or whatever I'm using is just going to pick up that one and then turn the data into the right configuration.
Yeah, again, I agree. I think so. But one of the tricky thing that when you're dealing with a network is that, you know, if you're making quite large changes that has an impact on the network, it might be that you can't just reconfigure one of your devices to the new version of the configuration. You have to change all of them at the same time. And if you don't, then you end up with a non-functioning network. And since the provisioning of the network itself usually relies on the network, it's very few, companies that have a complete out-of-band network, then you create a situation that you have to handle. So when comparing, writing this network provisioning code, I think it's slightly different. You have to think more about how you can transition from one version to the next version seamlessly in your network. It's not like a, classic database where you just, it's an atomic transition. It doesn't work like that when it's a, BGP neighbor that's involved or something. So it might be a little bit trickier, but apart from that, I do agree with David.
In terms of rolling out, say, a new service or let's say a differing set of services, or maybe you've done some tweaks to your patterns, have you got a kind of rollout policy? So you might start with an integration lab, you might do one particular region, and then you maybe expand out, so you might do 10 nodes, and then the next time you do 100 nodes, and the next time you do 500 nodes. So have you got any kind of a default strategy for rolling out those changes?
We don't. Thus far, the TerraStream, we're operating pilot networks, right? So it's not 100 of devices. And this is, it's very nice from our perspective, right? It's very little legacy, and it's easy to keep everything on the latest of whatever. But it is a question that we have asked ourselves. And some form of, canary deployment, you start out somewhere, you test it, make sure that, so even after you passed, your first CI test and regression testing, and you actually start deploying this into your network, even then, maybe you don't want to reprovision all of the devices in your network at the same time. Maybe you want to start off with a single node, make sure that also works okay, and then go iteratively through the network in ever increasing batches until you're done. But we don't have a default strategy that we're currently following.
In my case, we have several POPs. So what we do is just we develop on the lab POP, then we move onto the staging POP, and then we just pick a few canaries. Those are actually production POPs. And if everything goes well, then you just roll the changes everywhere.
So what's a canary?
A canary is just a POP where that has some characteristics like, you're running both IPv4 and IPv6, and you have this particular service. So more or less like certain characteristics of the POP, and then you run new code there, but only there. So you can catch like bugs that you might not have seen on the lab or on the staging environment. Because at the end of the day, you're not going to have that much traffic on the staging environment. So you don't know if your code is going to behave differently or if it's going to have like some memory leak somewhere. I mean, this applies not only for like network changes, but for like software changes that the rest of the organization might be doing.
And the name really comes from like a strategy point of view, from like proper CI/CD type of thing, where they kind of have different methods of how you systematically then roll out new versions into production. If you do it, on the whole production thing at once, or if you have a mirrored setup where you have everything twice kind of thing, and they have different terms for.
Yeah, so. I think the canary originally came from the mining where they used it right? So that if it dies quickly, not to do this.
Or not light a cigarette.
Yes.
I always have an issue, even though we kind of do it that way. I run it into dev and I run it into like one POP. And then once I roll it out on the entire network, I notice that there's something on this one router that is different from everything else that was not in any of the previous tests kind of thing. That's like that's the one problem that I run into a lot, where it's just hard from like a device that is this magic box that is a router that does its own thing kind of to, go into a complete test that covers all of the scenarios.
And is it worth writing the tests for that router, or do you just leave it? Like, that's kind of, to me, that's the question is, at what point, you know, David was saying this earlier, you could spend the rest of your life writing unit tests. Mm-hmm, but at what point is there a diminishing law of returns on how many of these you're writing?
Yeah. Eventually, I'd just give up. It might be, it might be differences like it has 6 line cards instead of 7, and then your test kind of works differently, and nowhere in the lab you have 7 line cards. You know, those kind of configuration scenarios can change how the hardware responds. So I usually just roll it out everywhere, and then kind of see if something broke after all the testing and after everything. But at least, the more stages of testing that you go through in advance, the less of those kind of errors sneak into production afterwards. So I think there's still a huge value in at least weeding out the easy ones in advance.
I think here is actually where mocking is very interesting, because if you have like something that behaves like a router, it's not a router, it's just a fake process that you wrote, but behaves like a router, and you can actually tweak the behavior. It's super easy to write regression tests for cases like this. Like, oh, I found this issue on this particular router. Okay, I just need to mock this particular behavior. And if I use now the Napalm hat, we do that a lot. Like, all the devices are mocked, and every time that someone report like a different output from a given device, like, oh, this is Juniper switch, so the output for this command is this one, but now this is the same command for a Juniper router, the output is slightly different. It's almost identical, but slightly different. Then it's super easy with the mock device that we have, just like copy paste that new output, and now you can test both the old one and the new one.
So David, can I ask then, have you got any tests that test those tests? So have you got a test, a log into the box, grab the output and actually test the output against what you've mocked? So do you have a test to test your mocks, or do you have it by hand at the moment? And that's a serious question.
Maybe if we step back, have we covered what a mock is for the network engineers yet?
Ah, sensible, Chris.
I'll be that guy. So my understanding of a mock is just basically a way that you can have your code respond with whatever your response, your desired response should be, and then use that as the input into your test rather than having to push it against a physical device. So it allows you just to have a complete self-contained test with no virtual devices, no virtual switches, routers, or physical, and you can just run and test based on that input. That's fair for everybody? Close enough?
Yeah. Yes. So I would say the minimum you could do is you just write a server which receives show IP route command, and then it opens show IP route.txt file and reads that and sends the results back.
Well, not even that. It's actually simpler than that. Like, for example, when I'm mocking a Juniper device, right? The only thing, like, you check into the PyC library, you have like a device class. And then you have an RPC class. The RPC class is the one that is actually talking to the device. So you send an XML call and you get back an XML response. So the only thing you have to tweak is that RPC class. So what I do is, for example, I translate that XML call into a string. And then I write a file with that string as a name. And I put the response into the file. So every time that the device class makes an RPC call, it's going to find that file and just return the content of that file.
Mm-hmm. I do the same thing.
So yeah. There is one benefit, though, to having these things either in a container or on a server, and that is if your remote node, say, version changes or whatever, you don't have to go in and swap all those files out. You could just maybe reload the container. I know it's another fragile link, but for more complex environments,
You're not suggesting networking vendors would ever change like output without telling people, are you?
No, we never do that. We don't ever introduce non-ASCII characters or white space into the CLI. We don't break anything like that, ever.
Yeah, but you don't have to replace the file. You just have several folders, one per device or OS version or whatever. And then you just iterate over all the folders and just run the same test against the files on those different folders.
I'm lazy, I guess. What I like to do is package those up into a container. It's kill one, start another up, and that's all I do. But it's I think both are reasonable strategies.
So then mocking is a way to get your tests to run in a much faster time frame, make your developers happy.
Yeah, it's also faster to write tests if you can mock them. Because, otherwise, it's, as Lisa was saying, her problem is that she has this unique device somewhere that maybe she can't have it on the lab, because you're not going to have all the potential devices that you're running on your network on the lab. Like, oh yeah, I have all these different hardware switches, and then I have they're running all these different versions. So it also speeds up how you can write tests.
So and I guess
the same off-vendor optic inserted in the lab as in production. Yeah, exactly. That's the problem.
Yeah, there are just too many variables.
So I suppose that our network is probably the kind of the ideal network here, since we make it a point of using equipment where we also have a virtual counterpart, so we can do tests like this. I mean, I understand that most networks aren't built like this, and most networks have a brownfield network, right? Where you started out with a lot of legacy kind of.
But even with vendors where you have that ability, like it always ends up being, you know, like great, Juniper has like a VMX thing, but then I run QFXs and what do I do now, right? So there's always a
virtual QFX as well. I don't know. I don't know if it you know, perfectly mimics that device that you have, but that's why we also use a physical CI environment. Again, I understand this isn't for everyone, but I think for us, we don't just give up and say, we're not going to be able to cover everything. At least we try to actually do cover everything, both in a virtual version as well as a physical counterpart in our lab. That's how we intend to test all aspects of our software.
What's going to happen when the network is like 5 or 10 years old, and then you have like 5 generations of routers, and then you have also like 6 different versions of their operating systems? I mean, as the network gets older, you just get more crap there as well.
Not necessarily. it might not sound very realistic, but I mean, a lot of service providers do forklift upgrades, right? I don't know why you would have 5 different software versions in your network. The networks that I've operated in the past, we've not tried to do that. I don't think that's particularly hard, actually, keeping it down to probably 2 versions. One is like your current, maybe, and one the new one you're moving to. And as for the hardware itself, yeah, forklift upgrades is, in a service provider environment, at least, it's a fairly common practice.
Well, I have seen Catalyst switches running still. And with Catalyst, I mean CatOS.
CatOS, yes. I pulled one out last year.
Yeah, so I don't know.
I'm not doubting that. But then the question also remains, I mean, these devices, are they, you know, a very active part in your service delivery? If we're talking about something that you've written provisioning code for, is this actually one of the devices that are included in that? Or is this just something for, I don't know, something obscure niche on the side?
I think it's safe to say as well, we're moving forward as an industry. I think we're kind of embracing software properly, or beginning to at least, where hopefully we accept that, you know what, our switch or router might upgrade itself every week, or, you know, we might just have to do these things to try and keep everything uniform so we can automate and we can do tests. It's something that I've noticed slowly over the last 2 or 3 years. I don't know what your experience is. I mean, obviously software networking is completely different, but from a traditional networking point of view, it wasn't, I think, always will be a nightmare.
Just the fact that we have 5 people on a call passionately talking about testing is already, wow, imagine that a couple of years ago in networking.
And all with a networking background.
Right.
It is, you know, a very interesting thing, right? And this, it's a basic philosophical thing almost, that do you try to make sense of the chaos, or do you try to order your reality? You know, as you progress, do you do forklift upgrades? Do you just throw away old equipment just so that you have everything in order? Or do you try to somehow make sense of a chaotic environment?
Well, that's really deep, but mostly that's financial. Mostly that's a financial question, isn't it?
Yeah, correct. I mean, that's the main problem.
Well, I think there's a technical aspect to it as well. And so the whole thing around logging, SNMP traps, syslog, and what you do around that is one aspect of it. I mean, if you ask most people, they have no idea what might actually turn up in their syslog tomorrow. Do you know ahead of time what the potential messages are from your devices? The answer is probably no. So how are you going to possibly write rules to react on them if you don't know what they are, right? That's one of those things. Do you try to make sense of the chaos, or do you instead try to enforce such that the messages that might come from a device ahead of time?
It's just hard to cover all of the scenarios, right? I typically, and on a question like that, I would typically have some kind of framework where I can throw in one message that I know this is going to be it, and have it kind of extensible in a way that as new ones show up, I can add to it. Which is also like the point of like fast,
And I don't think that makes sense to try to foresee every potential scenario. I think it's better to have like a good system where you can detect anomalies. You might not know what's happening, but you know that there is something wrong, and then just like, sure, now I know that that could happen. Then you can actually write some alerting around that. So I think that anomalies is more interesting than actually trying to foresee everything, because you're not going to be able to foresee everything.
But to Christian's point, that's anomalies that affect the service, though, isn't it? If you try and order the chaos or make sense of it in your own kind of context. We've all seen weird syslogs, but does it actually affect what we're doing? And I think if you have an environment made of all different things, that's the only, I think, logic that you can lock down at this point. I mean, I might be wrong on this, but...
And unless broken is your standard operating procedure, that's an anomaly, right? That's the other
problem.
If
not broken, it works, right?
Yep. Well, yeah, sometimes broken is standard, right? In a lot of enterprises, that's...
You're making it gray now, Chris. So if we say how broken...
how spanning broken tree broken, yes.
Okay, so now that Chris mentioned how broken, are you guys doing any post-deployment tests? So yes, you tested everything, you got to the point where you say this is safe to deploy, and now you deploy it. Are you waiting for the phones to ring, or are you doing post-deployment tests?
Yes, we are. But that is, I mean, that's normal monitoring of your network, right? Or do you mean specifically in connecting this back into your kind of a CI system?
Well, normal monitoring of the network is usually, are the links up, are the sessions up, are whatever things up. But how about, do I still have HSRP neighbors? Does the traffic still pass through my network if I change the access control list? Yes, the neighbors are up, but do I get the right number of prefixes from my BGP peers? Is my traffic going the right way?
But this is where the anomaly detection comes in handy. Again, like if you're monitoring your network, you know, like, oh, on a, like on a, like normally I get like this amount of prefixes from my peers. Normally I have this amount of traffic on these interfaces. So I can just deploy things and then just my monitoring will tell me if there is some deviation from the standard.
So to link these two together, does your CI pipeline generate the operational tests, or generally are they done by a different team? Because that can make the difference whether your monitoring is actually good enough in the first place to pick up the anomaly.
So in our case, it's the same thing. Like I mentioned, right, that we integrate this very tightly in our abstraction. Our abstraction is the service, and the service contains both the code to provision something as well as monitor it. So it is the same thing that we're using in CI testing as in monitoring the network later on, for most part, I should say. It's fair and good questions here, right? I mean, does the BGP, is it as expected? We do not cover that in a post-deployment scenario. What we do test is that we test the BGP policies of our routers. That's functional testing. It's a black box. So we perform the exact same test regardless of which router vendor it is, because it's all just standardized BGP going in and out of it. And we have a number of BGP speakers, originating routes, and then you look at the received routes and you make sure, you know, does it look correct or not? So that's how we do that. We wouldn't cover we're doing a change, you know, across versions. We will not be able to detect the change there. But since you have a test, just changing the policy will, of course, result in the test failing.
But maybe your expected policy is not really covering everything, you know, that it should be covering if some crap comes off your peer kind of situation. I've always wondered about setting something up where you actually simulate like external things that it just send you, you know, random stuff to test for.
So do you mean random as in random prefixes, or random as in fuzzing the protocol itself?
Yeah. I was kind of thinking along the lines, well, fuzzing the prefixes really. So, you know, you don't really know what they're going to be kind of thing. But there's definitely a lot that we could explore in that direction. But that's the really hard one, because you don't really have to only set up your network to test against, but you also kind of have to set up the network around you.
Yes, I agree. It is very difficult. So I just said that this is black box testing. It is from one perspective, right? Because we don't know if it's a Cisco, Juniper, or something else router. But from another perspective, it's not. Because when we write the tests, we do have detailed knowledge of the routing policies. So we test, you know, we send in a prefix. It has a certain BGP community attached to it. And when that community is there, certain actions are supposed to be taken by the router. And we verify that. And sure, I mean, it's possible that we missed something. We have missed quite a few things, but we also do test a fair portion of it. Fuzzing this could definitely help, but it's also one of the difficult parts is when you're fuzzing, what is the expected outcome? when you're fuzzing a protocol, it's kind of like, yeah, your BGP sessions should always stay up or something like this. The output or result of it is more well known.
It should catch that something bad is happening, right? No matter what it is you're sending.
Yeah.
Hey, here's a problem. Whatever that problem might be, it might not know specifically, but.
Right. But I found at least, I mean, I hope you can enlighten me on this, but I found it very, very difficult to actually define that if we're talking about a BGP route policy.
I agree with you. I mean, I'm doing something similar to what you described. Like, I mean, I'm lucky enough to run BERT on the switches. So that means that I can actually build like a testing environment for BGP like super easily with Docker. And so I have a couple of Docker containers running BERT, and I just apply the policies on one of them. And then on the other one, the only thing I have to do is, okay, I know that I'm being sent these routes with this community, so I need to check that these changes actually happened on these particular prefixes. And when I find like, well, that the testing didn't get, then I just add it to the testing environment.
Right. It sounds very similar to what we're doing as well, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, what Aliza is really talking about are the unknown unknowns.
Yes, but I mean, we can definitely inject the unknown unknowns, or well, we can randomly generate prefixes, right? But what do we expect out of it? That's a difficult thing to define here. Do we expect that the router just propagate them, or are they supposed to be caught by some sanity filter? In that case, how do we define that? That is the part that I find very difficult to actually define.
This also goes to David's point about tying your operations team. Your development team, right, is that the operations team, there is nothing we're ever going to be able to do to get all the unknown unknowns. The only people that are being able to find those is the operations team. So the testing can never be done, right? We just have to keep having that feedback loop from operations back into the development to make sure the regression tests are covered and added to over time.
Yes, which makes it a reactive thing rather than a proactive thing. But I agree with you. I think this is unfortunately, it is the best that we can do in this case.
An unknown unknown. Generally, can we make it as simple as it's working or it isn't working? We've got an unknown unknown, something's happened, it's an anomaly, somebody investigates, and then just like say that whole feedback thing, we now know this is an anomaly. I mean, you can't account for everything.
I will tell you one of the most interesting things for me from a testing, to bring this back to networking engineers trying to get into this today, was just generating configurations for my devices and then just doing a diff between what my ideal state was versus what was the crap actually running in production. Just that was absolutely mind-blowing.
Ah, so Chris, you did the same thing that the guys from Facebook did, right?
Yeah, I decided to do this after I did a zero-touch provisioning to a certain IP address that had been allocated to three devices and didn't go to the right one. Want to guess whether it was the core router or not that actually got redeployed? Anybody?
Yeah, that's actually why I have this philosophy that you don't apply incremental changes to a device. You just regenerate everything and then apply it to the device. Like every time I do, I just a full provisioning of the device, even if it's just a description change.
But there's also the assumption that the device can reload a full configuration.
Oh, yeah.
Without rebooting.
Well, most can do nowadays.
Not all.
I know a major vendor with data center switches that still can't do configuration replace.
iOS can do it nowadays. If you're running iOS 15, I think that's XE, that can do it.
No, iOS was doing that for almost a decade. iOS wasn't a problem for a long time. I was talking about some data center switches that I will not name.
Well, no,
there's plenty that don't.
Well, I mean, the three major ones can do it, I would say.
There's lots of enterprise stuff. Again, there's a lot of stuff out there that is legacy gear that we don't have that same ability to just redeploy an entire configuration. So that's something to be aware of for the listeners, that you might want to test this in a lab first.
I am changing my mind on it, though. I've always been, David and I were arguing about that over a year ago already, with like, he wants to rewrite the whole thing, and I never wanted to, because it also depends on how you're set up. Like, I get services injected into routers from like different sides, really. So nothing is in charge of the entire configuration at a time, which kind of makes that happen. I found a really nice thing on Junipers where if I replace config portions, I use that replace tag to like make sure I'm replacing the entire block, which is kind of the kind of in between replacing your whole config and adding lines to it.
That's, I have to mention that as well. I mean, this is a feature of when you're using netconfig yang, right? That the verb kind of that you use to work with your configuration, well, I think they're very good and it makes it very easy to work with. And the one you're talking about here, replacing a section of the configuration, is one of those. And it makes it very easy to do these kinds of things.
Let's just say that this depends on the quality of the NetConf implementation on the vendor box.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. I've seen my fair share of rather bad implementations of this. I work with them, unfortunately, every day. So I'm well aware, but things are definitely getting better on this front as well.
Okay, now we are obviously in moaning myrtle mode, so it's time to wrap up. Christian, if people listening to this podcast will get questions afterwards, can they get in touch with you? And if so, how?
Yes, absolutely. So Twitter would be one, and I'm also on Slack, IRC, there's email. Perhaps it would be possible to list links together with the podcast. Yeah, I think that would be the easiest.
Okay, so if anyone has a question, you'll find Christian's Twitter handle in the blog post that goes with the podcast. David B., where can people find you?
Well, I'm on Twitter, LinkedIn, email. We can probably link them on the blog as well.
And they can always open an issue on Napalm GitHub, right?
Yeah, they can. I hope it's related to Napalm, though.
So if we're promoting our open source software, I'd actually make a quick statement here. So for people who want to get interested, I wrote a piece of software called VRNetLab, which is precisely for running virtual routers using Docker containers. And that's what we're using in our CI system. I find it very convenient since it provides kind of a standard interface, regardless if you're working with a VMX, a Cisco XRV router, or something else. So VRNetLab, check it out.
I am.
Very cool.
Elisa, what open source software do you want to promote?
I'm with Napalm, although I don't answer the tickets there. So. Yeah, David is totally on top of that. But Twitter, email, everything, my details are on bigwaveit.org.
Chris.
At NetmanChris on Twitter and all the other places too. Other than that, I think this week I'm just looking for my missing VMs.
Oh yeah, you'll find them. Don't worry. It's vSphere. You'll find them. If it would be Amazon, it would cost you. Now it's free. And David G., where can people find you?
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at vtep42 and on my blog, ipengineer.net, and my email address is on the blog as well.
So thank you, everyone, for this podcast. I hope people got some idea how to test their networks out of this. And I'm even
Or just more confused.
Well, if they got more confused, then write to Christian and David and Elisa, because they were the ones confusing you.
It's like when you were learning MPLS. If you're confused, you actually got it.
Agreed.
Yes, agreed. So thanks, everyone. And I'm Ivan Pepelniak, and you've been listening to Software Gone Wild, a podcast on everything software defined. You want to know more about the podcast, just go to podcast.ipspace.net and explore.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Software Gone Wild. If you want to learn more about software-defined networking, network automation, and related topics, visit sdn.ipspace.net and explore our courses, books, webinars, and podcasts.